Phone check. 1, 2, the microphone check. 1, 2, 1, 2, the microphone check. I got my headphones tuned between two different AM stations, and my briefcase is full of declassified information. Declassified, declassified, and I'm reading it under the lens of your radio. I'm dissecting it and bleeding it. I read the world for breakfast, and after lunch I write it. I let me get me down, and then I stand back up and fight it. I read the news today, oh boy, oh boy. I know linguistics, statistics, pundits, and mystics. I voted for Ralph Nader. I read Docs and Raider. I got 1,000 signatures and sent them to Darth Vader. I'm reading U.S. News and World Report, Time Life, and The Post. I know more than other DJs because I read the most. And when I squint to the west, I can see Afghanistan. I put my head between my knees and I can see Iran. I get documents online and then I analyze them. They know I'm out there waiting so they don't declassify them. I bug the White House and I bug the Pentagon. In the filling in my molar, I got my descrambler on. I got the truth. I got Paul Muth. We got better lines than Haydn Carruth. We put our 11 cents in, just like Marx and Lenin. Paul's like Carl McCartney, but I'm John Lennon. We'd love to turn you on. I say I want a revolution, and I want to stop it all. I finished all 3 volumes up of Marx's Capital. You know, everything that old boy wrote is up on my shelf, and every single bit I translated myself. I'm reading and I'm learning, and when the tide is turning, it'll warm my heart in part to see the dollar bills burning. They weren't built in a day, but all roads lead to Rome. I'll do fine just as the Romans with my main man, Rome. I'd like to tell you a story about a little man, if I can. A gnome whose name was Chomsky. I'm MCS of the Rook. I got a voice like milk. I'm the best dressed man you ever heard. Can you hear this tie? It's silk.
It's mid-morning on the last day of the week, and you're listening to News from Neptune. Carl Estabrook and Paul Muth discussing the news of the week and its coverage by the media. Archives of this show in free software formats are available at newsfromneptune.com. Thanks to the technical expertise of Dr. No, Jeff Nicholson Owens.
And it's the 11th of February. You sent your Valentine cards out, Paul?
Do you want to talk about St. Valentine's Day and his prison stay or anything like that?
Well, I don't know. I figured your Valentine to Scott Simon was not stamped and delivered yet.
Oh, he's our voice we can trust, according to the people that are pitching for
Wasn't that something this morning?
Yeah, I'm distressed.
Paul and I are both on Saturday mornings put off a bit by the weekend edition of NPR News. Scott Simon is the voice of that, and yes, they're singing his praises. I don't think he deserves it.
Weekend edition, as we like to call it.
Very definitely. Very definitely.
Well, we'll try and do something here, I guess. There's certainly enough to critique this week. In fact, there's way too much.
Like, yeah, as usual.
The Art of Saying Nothing was the editorial response of the New York Times to Gonzalez's defense of the... the spying.
They don't have to say anything. Look, I've got a question for you. Do you think, as I was pulling together notes for this week, it was looking to me as if there's a CIA war breaking out. The CIA is, funny things are coming out of the CIA in regard to the administration, and I put in mind, taken back all those years to the Watergate affair, when there were people who argued, and I must admit I found some of the arguments at least plausible, that the Watergate imbroglio, that teapot tempest that ended in the departure of Richard Nixon from the presidency, actually had been engineered by the CIA, that the CIA from the beginning had thought that Nixon was dangerously unbalanced, and certainly subsequent information suggests they were right about that, and that they did what they could to encourage his departure. That that one of the members, one of the Watergate burglars, was in fact a double agent working for the plumbers in the White House and for the CIA, and that indeed the case opened up only when he decided and told the judge that the administration was planning for the CIA to take the fall. Well, I don't know. I mean, there's funny stuff around. There's an article.
Yeah, there's no the CIA. There's a lot of factions
inside. That's a good point.
And there's actually, now that they've got Negroponte over the whole outfit.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, Cheney did a sit-down with Jim Lehrer this week.
He certainly
did. Asked point blank, or was quoted, Jay Rockefeller, who wrote that scribble letter to Cheney about his misgivings about the eavesdropping by
the NSA. Virginia senator.
Mm-hmm. He was asked directly if the leaks came from the White House, and he said, well, we're investigating. We can't talk about it yet. But it's clear that NSA, a lot of disgruntled NSA people, leaked all this stuff.
Yep.
And some of them were supposedly willing to come and testify to an intelligence committee, if there's an intelligence committee that wants to investigate it, which is a good question. They only announced that they were going to have some hearings on the issue in the midst of the Judiciary Committee hearings. They set a date after it was provoked, apparently, and they'll probably bury it. I was just noting Thursday's News Gazette editorial saying we need to start talking about what this eavesdropping issue is really about, which is protecting us from terrorism, digressions like investigating Quakers and things like that, which is... You know, that's exactly what undermines any credibility of this, is all the other things that are going on. And it was some NSA sorts of military people that were actually investigating this Quaker group in Texas called Project Truth or something like that. So, you know, they think it's a digression, and that, of course, we have to limit the subject to what the administration wants to talk about.
Well, that's the administration's line, our local paper, in not unusually, is simply parroting the administration's line on that. But what seems to me to be happening rather interestingly is the administration's line has fewer and fewer supporters. The administration position is falling apart, as it were, internally. I mean, the folks that normally you would expect to rally to the administration are not. You're certainly right that there are factions within the CIA. Porter Goss, the new director of the CIA, was in the New York Times op-ed page this week saying, oh, it's terrible that all these newspapers are revealing things about the CIA because, of course, that tells our enemies things. Well, it might be worthwhile to think about who the administration's enemies really are. Of course, the primary enemy of the administration, and they know it, we're not telling them anything they don't know, is the American people. And it's the American people who have to be bamboozled and propagandized and manipulated and so forth so that the Bush administration can go on doing what they really want to do, which is enrich their base. But in the meantime, the way they've chosen to do it, the way we've been watching for two administrations them do it, is that they scare us today. With tales of terror, and how only they, the administration, the military, can keep us safe from terror. Now, I thought we had a particularly egregious example of that this week when Bush says, well, of course, we foiled an attack on L.A., the Liberty Tower, he said. It was, in fact, apparently the Library Tower and is now called something else. But he says, we foiled an attack there, and we did it because we're keeping you safe from terrorism. Now, immediately, there was a rush to the media of unnamed CIA, NSA, and FBI agents all saying, this is nonsense, he's making it up, he's talking through his hat, and less charitable descriptions of what Bush was doing. It's based on worthless intelligence and so forth. Now, this is very odd on several scores, it seems to me, Paul. First of all, why does the administration choose to say that now, particularly in what they say seems to be such a ramshackle lie? I mean, whatever happened in Los Angeles, wherever they actually found some people sympathetic to Al-Qaeda who was saying, wouldn't it be a good idea if we did something like this on the West Coast? It may have got that far. If they actually had people who were conspiring in this way, you would expect to have seen trials, right? They would not wait now to mention it 3 years later. Even the mayor of Los Angeles said, by the way, somebody should have told me. And
they didn't even tell him he was going to make the announcement.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Well, I mean,
so what's going on?
It's clearly a smokescreen. The point is all these denials and things that were and retractions of it by the CIA and undermining, you know, how far do they get? You know, a lot of the way that Americans watch the news is they'll just see the soundbite of Bush saying this, and they may hear something about some criticism of it, but they'll say, well, that's just natural that there'll be some people undercutting it. And of course,
that's what
the intentions are good, et cetera, et cetera.
The administration wants, and some Americans do that. In fact, the polls seem to suggest that a lot of Americans are not buying that stuff right now, and that what seems to me to be going on is that as criticism grows in amongst the American populace, we find the administration's facade crumbling. It's got all these people stepping forward from within the administration or within the Republican Party or the Republican Party in the Congress saying, wait a minute, there's something wrong with this line that the administration is taking. They're defending us from terror, and therefore they can't be asked about what they're doing. That's breaking down, and it's breaking down, it seems to me, in a rather surprising way. Or to a rather surprising degree, at least.
Well, I'm no fan of Lindsey Graham, but
he's not dumb, at least.
He intervened with Gonzalez in a way that really shocked me.
Yes.
He tied it directly to the torture memos and just said, you know, what is the limitation?
Exactly.
If this is a wartime right, and Gonzalez just kept doing the same thing. Well, we're not talking about that.
Yes.
He said, well, I'm asking you a question about that. Well, we're not talking about that. I'm here to talk about this.
Yeah.
And it's like, give me a break. It went on. It was repeated so many times where he just said, you know, he tried to stay to the hack party line that they had developed for him and wouldn't answer questions, even when they were just general questions about another issue.
Seems to me important, Paul. I mean, you've chosen, and it seems to me an important example. Here's Lindsey Graham, a Republican senator, and clearly one of the smartest of the bunch. I mean, he's nobody's dummy. Exasperated with this smokescreen that the Attorney General is putting up. An obscure congressional representative from Albuquerque who chairs a subcommittee supposedly overlooking the NSA says this week the NSA is off the reservation.
Yeah.
I suppose coming from where she does, she uses the word advisedly.
Don't look for any checks from the RNC.
Exactly.
So it seems to me that some of these Republicans who are backing this need to say, well, hey, we'll have some alternate funding for you,
but
that kind of bald-faced threat is not going to.
And why? Yes, it's a bald-faced threat from Rove. I mean, it's surprising that he makes the threat at all, and it's certainly surprising that he makes it publicly.
Yeah,
what's going on here? And it seems to me that they do that only when they are in substantial disarray.
I don't know how it was released. I mean, was it a public threat? It was a threat that was released. I think it
certainly
might have been.
It was publicized far and wide.
Well, I think somebody that got it was annoyed by it so much. They just said, you know, this is what it's gone to. So.
But the fact that at this stage of this administration, Karl Rove finds it necessary to threaten Republican senators and congressmen, congresspeople, with withdrawal of funds if they don't support the administration's line on spying and so forth. I mean, that's a sign of desperation, seems to me.
Well, I'm a little more than a little desperate about Durbin caving in on the Patriot
Act. Yes, isn't that terrible?
I think people need to drop him some lines.
Boy, I would say so. Yeah,
phone calls.
Maybe he needs to. Well,
I mean, the idea that libraries are now it's ambiguous as to whether these national security letters have any legal weight, according to some people.
Yeah.
So, the traditional role of the library, I guess, the idea there is that if the librarians were already planning on cooperating with the FBI if they got one of these national security letters, they would go ahead and do it, and basically it would be status quo. But I don't know. You know, it's totally ambiguous as to what this is, and it seems to be pretty much window dressing for letting the Patriot go and not having a big battle over it, because I guess the Democrats think that since it seems to be 50-50 on the NSA eavesdropping itself, according to what poll and how is the question asked, et cetera, that they just don't have the chutzpah to make the calls. And we have people like
Graham,
Republicans who are actually, and this woman from New Mexico, who she's got apparently a tough battle right
now.
Yeah,
she does.
And
she may not
General,
be reelected.
Another woman from New Mexico is right on her heels. So that's maybe why she made the announcement, but that's also maybe why she might need the money, and maybe she'll cave later. I don't know.
Well, but this Patriot Act thing is an important point too. I mean, the Senators have suggested they have a deal on the Patriot Act with the administration, and it was absolutely eyebrow raising that Durbin should step forward and say, "Yeah, it's a good deal. I'll vote for it." This is pretty outrageous because there is, I think, a fair amount of dismay across the country at the Patriot Act and what the Patriot Act represents, plus the fact, as the act wends its way through the Congress, it becomes a grab bag of police powers and invasions of civil liberties. The thing changes and moves around. It's a blob of repressive law, and to say now it's the blob has been reshaped into an acceptable deal is a surprising thing for Senator Durbin to do. He can't quite figure that. Maybe he's afraid John McCain will write him a nasty letter, the way his colleague got one this week. But this is not right, and there should be more outcry about it. I mean, in terms of our own senator, because there is a general dismay across the country about the Patriot Act.
Yeah. Bush is looking pretty disheveled to me. We know he's just what is it called? He's the real power. I like the name of the previous name of the book by John Nichols, Dick, the Man Who Was President, which is in paperback is called The Rise and the Rise of Richard B. Cheney. Apparently they didn't like the name of it, but he's a figurehead. But he's looking pretty disheveled, and I wasted a little time on a blog that was talking about how there's a bust, bronze bust of memorializing Bush's service in the Texas National Guard. Maybe it shows his back because that's mostly what
that's
they,
what
saw,
they
him,
saw.
Saw of him
I
leaving.
Like that. That's
but
clever.
I brought it up because I was listening to Inside the Beltway radio, and this idiot Fred Barnes from the Murdoch's
Weekly Standard.
Weekly Standard.
Yep.
Has got a
certified
book
idiot
called Rebel in Chief, where he's lionizing Bush as, you know, breaking all the molds, etc.,
yeah, right.
etc. Well,
there's some truth to that.
And
but not
he said on, he said on the radio that Bush had volunteered to fly in Vietnam, and he was challenged on it. And they brought him back the end of the week and said, you know, what is the basis for this? Well, apparently it was some puff piece autobiography that of Bush that he didn't write that said that he had at some point inquired as to whether he could join this program that spelled people where they put in some people from National Guard, Air Corps, National Guard to fly and give some relief to the bombers in Vietnam era. You know, the whole point there is, you know, he asked about it and they made it a big deal in this publicity piece. The fact that people could take it seriously when, you know, his intentions about flying he was denied access to the program because he hadn't logged enough hours. Well, mm-hmm. Why was that? Because he wasn't showing up. He was flying a plane that wasn't even being used anymore. It was being phased out. It was clearly a champagne appointment, to a way of being in the military but not going to Vietnam for sure.
And the
fact that they could take it seriously, and that he could, and then they could have an argument about what's going on, what were his intentions. It was just absolutely surreal, absolutely surreal. But then, you know, then I read that they're actually memorializing his time in the National Guard with a bronze. So, this is the kind of denial and BS that's going on right now, and it's astonishing.
Yeah, it was probably champagne. I think it's probably a euphemism there. I think it was probably another substance that was in his bloodstream that may have caused some difficulties about his flying in those days.
I guess that was the name that they used at the time.
Yes, I understand.
For luxurious appointments.
I understand. I was just trying to
continue the metaphor.
What
have you heard any more scuttlebutt about whether he's drinking again?
I did. Democracy Now! This week ran a two-part interview with the woman who was responsible for the producing the CBS account
Mary
of the
Bates.
Documents that referred to Bush's Air National Guard service. I use the word advisedly. It was interesting. I mean, as you reflect on that little incident, why the CBS embarrassment of those documents, the most striking thing, of course, is that the arguments settled on the provenance of the documents and their reliability rather than the issues they talked about and the whole question of what Bush himself had done. Now, this is itself part of the personalization of politics in America. I mean, when you have political parties that don't stand for anything, it means they stand for a lot, so, but still... there is a tendency to personalize the politics. Malgré lui, there's no better way, nothing else you can do. So we see, even now, a remarkable concentration on who might run for president in 2008. We mentioned a little McCain flap this week. But it's a shame, in a way, the concentration on the personal peccadilloes of these people, and there are plenty of them. Peccadilloes, I mean, people as well, I suppose, because the issues, the questions, the matter of who actually is running the country for what purposes, that gets lost. And so we worry about Bush or McCain or Cheney or one of these people and don't look at what they're doing.
I was traveling this week, so I didn't get to hear most of Democracy Now!, but I did hear the second part of that one, and it was astonishing to hear that she says this business about the font and the proportional spacing and all that is not really true. She says she has documents from the time where that kind of stuff was generated. And the woman who said, well, this is basically what the guy believed, but I didn't type this because it's got too many typos in it. Well, she wasn't the only person to type for the guy. I don't know. It's amazing if they actually blog the beat that to death with the blog. As she says, there's never been any authoritative statement that those documents weren't actually from that era, that weren't true. So, I don't know. Like you say, though, what's that got to do with billions of dollars being bilked out of the government and 147 programs being cut? And,
precisely.
Yeah, and the only thing that's getting an increase is the war industries.
And a half a million dead people in Iraq, exactly. Since those are the politics we are offered, the politics of personality rather than policy, we might notice one of the things that's happened this week is that one of the gamiest of these personalities looking for the presidential nomination for 2008, Majority Leader Frist and the... in the Senate, has spent the week distancing himself from Bush and attacking the administration from the right. Now, this is interesting, Paul. I mean, here's
that. What is it, on what basis? That
they should have sent more troops to Iraq. That Bush has not behaved as efficiently as he should have, dealing with the problems that the country faces, such as beefing up the military, so forth and so on. I mean, it's interesting sort of stuff. He's saying basically what Hillary Clinton and various Democrats are saying, too. I mean, these people feel that they, although the populace as a whole is extremely critical of the administration from the left, so to speak, they believe they can't do that because the people they speak for, the people in the federal government and the people who are paying them, are not in that position. Therefore, in order to attack the administration, they have to attack it from the right. Well, Frist is doing this too. This seems to me to be another example of this crumbling we're seeing in the administration's position. I mean, it's now being said, Paul, that it's not out of the question that the Democrats could regain the House of Representatives in the fall elections, and of course it's at least statistically possible for them to regain the Senate. Now, don't think it's going to happen.
You were quite skeptical of that.
But exactly, that's I'm reading the polls, and the polls have changed.
Yeah.
I mean, as recently as a month ago, people who were polling that saying it's out of the question. I mean, it still is highly unlikely the Democrats would gain either House of Congress. Exactly. I mean, there's only a few seats in the House of Representatives that are in play. But the fact of the matter is that as the mood of the country changes, as the criticisms of this government become more substantial, then more seats do come into play. And you only need a change of a dozen or so in order to, I think actually the number is 15, but still, in order, and it's a big number, in order to give the Democrats back the House of Representatives. And as I say, people are saying it's possible now, whereas recently as a month ago, pollsters said it wasn't.
Well, given how desperate that would make the administration, one wonders
what
they'll do. I saw your piece in Counterpunch about Kalanchistan?
Khuzestan.
Khuzestan. Has that also been called Baluchistan in the past?
No, I don't think so. That's, yeah.
Because that was the area that was in contestation in the 50s. And I thought that was the oil-rich area, so I don't know.
That was with the contestation with the Soviets, right?
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, but it was over a region that was oil-rich. So
no, this is the neocons are talking about the fact that 90% of Iran's oil actually comes from this one region on the border with Iraq. And the neocons are now saying, well, of course, you know, we can't attack Iraq. Iraq is not a prostrate country.
Can't
the way
take Iran, you mean.
Sorry. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. We can't attack Iran the way we attacked Iraq, say the neocons, because we only attack prostrate countries, and Iran is not a prostrate country. It's four times the size of Iraq, and it has a serious military. You know, the U.S. finds itself in a very peculiar military political situation in the Middle East right now. If we look at the result of the administration's policy over the last 4 years, we have produced a vast and self-conscious Shiite Muslim area which controls most of the world's oil.
I like it if you'd say, since you said the administration, you could say they have produced. Neither of us had much to do with U.S. policy, of course.
Well, right. Yeah, that's the problem. U.S. policy did it, and unfortunately, as Americans, when we talk about U.S. policy, this is a government that we're responsible for. This is a government that we have some purchase on, a government that, you know, and I worry sometimes about the notion that we can distance ourselves from it by saying they. Yeah, they've done it. The administration has done it. But there is a sense in which we've allowed them to. And
the
results.
To steal some elections and things like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, the results have been really contrary to the administration's interests, in the sense that we now have an effective alliance between the puppet government we've set up in Iraq and Iran on the basis of the Shiite connection. And across the way in Saudi Arabia, most of the oil producing areas of Saudi Arabia, although Saudi Arabia is predominantly Sunni, those areas are Shiite as well. Yeah. And so the U.S. is sitting looking at a situation that has produced a potential rival and for control of Middle East oil, which has always been the issue for the American government, at least since the Second World War, a potential rival that has powers that it's never had before. Yeah, and we've done that.
What would happen in Iraq if the U.S. even did a so-called surgical strike on Iran? The Badr Brigade was trained in Iran. They were fighting on the side of the Iranians, most of them, the older ones, during the Iran-Iraq War. Their allegiance is very much to their own country, but it's also to Iran.
That's
if
exactly
the US
right.
Mucks it up. You know, what would happen in Iraq? Iraq would you'd have the strongest militia, which there are so
yep.
many of them, the Badr Brigade, probably starting to frag
absolutely
U.S. soldiers in Iraq.
They've said as much. And Andrew Coburn, who wrote a very good piece on the about the fact that Jimmy Carter had given Iran 62 hostages in the embassy there, but that George Bush has given Iran 130,000 hostages, in that the American military in Iraq is vulnerable to attack from, as you say, within, that is the Iranian-oriented Shiite militias in Iraq and to Iran itself. So yeah, it's a military situation that cannot make the uniformed military very happy in the U.S. And it's a political situation. The U.S. is concerned to keep control of this oil by the use of the Arab facade, by the use of the constructing an Iraqi government that we like. And the outcome at the moment is not happy at all from the point of view of those American
and then
goals.
If you rule out military things and start squeezing Iran, attacking them for manipulating the cartoon Kampf, as it's been called in der Spiegel, we squeeze Iran, what happens to the world economy? So there's an incredibly complicated circumstance there too. How the U.S. is top of everything, but frustrated by the realities, it seems. You know, what kind of empire is this anyway?
Did you see the wonderful thing this week where the head of Shin Bet,
thought he was off the record, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But he said, this is the Israeli secret police, the head of Shin Bet said, gee, it was a mistake to get rid of Saddam Hussein because Saddam Hussein controlled Iraq, basically, for us. And now Iraq is out of control. And this, by the way, I mean, he's... agrees with people like Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, who said just the same thing right after the 1991 war, and explaining, you know, why the U.S. did not overthrow the government of Iraq after the first Gulf War. But here it is coming home to roost in peculiar places, including the Israeli secret police.
Israel may, quote, rue Saddam overthrow. Yeah. A strong dictatorship would be preferable to chaos in Iraq.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, the ironies are replete, aren't they? I mean, here explanation sub 5 or whatever it was by the U.S. about why we're killing Arabs was that, of course, we're establishing democracy in the region. We're giving an example, sort of a reverse domino theory, you know. If we set up one democratic domino, then all the other dominoes will jump up and look like that. I mean, it's as foolish as the image is, but in any case, you have to say that the Bush policy has had democratic effects in the region. The Palestinians democratically elected a party with the overwhelming enthusiasm of the Palestinian electorate. And now the Russians have invited this party, Hamas, to come talk to them, and there's great viewings with alarm and outrage on the part of the U.S. and Israel. The egregious John McCain says we shouldn't go to the G8 meetings in Russia because Russia is behaving so badly. I mean,
they're part of the quartet, but apparently they're playing some notes that were approved in advance.
Exactly, exactly. Astonishing.
Anyway, well, we haven't said anything about the comic camp except for a mild passing. Someone did some research for me. I said I was traveling. I posted that I'd heard Ali Abu Nima from the Electric Infada. I don't know whether he'll be invited back to the Liar Hour on PBS, because he was really brutal in a very satisfying way to this tool from University of Maryland. Who is this guy? I'm drawing a blank on the guy's name now. He's a Lebanese guy who is basically a mouthpiece for the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. And he was paired with Ali Abu Nima, and Ali Abu Nima was great, and the pretext was partially about the reaction around the Islamic world to the so-called Danish cartoons. And he mentioned that The Guardian had an article about the fact that the same paper, Jyllands Posten, had turned down a satirical cartoons of Christ. And mm-hmm. quoting the editor, who is now willing to post the Holocaust cartoons from Iran at the same time, quoting the guy who said that he would do that, said, "I don't think the readers of the Jyllands Posten would be pleased with the drawings. I think they would cause an outrage. That's why I won't use them." This is referring to the satirical cartoons depicting Jesus Christ in mm-hmm. April 2003. Mm-hmm. So
he was willing to cause outrage elsewhere, though.
Yeah, he was. This was published by a competing paper in, I guess it's based in Copenhagen, isn't mm-hmm. it? Lovely Copenhagen, where they have a street called Count Funk Benedotte, which mm-hmm. he was the guy. His name is kind of Sicilian sounding because he's actually was one of Napoleon's generals.
Right.
Legacy.
Napoleon put him in charge. You know, made the family king of
Funk Benedotte
of Denmark. Right.
He was assassinated by the air gun in Israel Palestine when it was a Palestinian mandate, when the UN was first getting involved in trying to resolve something in the 30s. So. They have a long legacy of attention, and it's ironic that milk from Denmark is being burnt and not U.S. U.S. stuff. But I guess there's also already an informal boycott of a lot of things American anyway, actually.
These the cartoon conf, as you say, is important in once again as a propaganda measure all over. I mean, the way it's being played in the U.S. of course is look at these mad Muslims. They get upset about a cartoon. We wouldn't get upset about a cartoon, unless it attack some other things. As a result, they're doing bad stuff, and we have to obviously have to stand against that. I mean, I think it's another sign of the administration's desperation that they have turned more and more recently in the direction of saying what we're dealing with here really is a clash of civilizations. It is radical Islam that is the enemy. For a while, they borrowed Christopher Hitchens' phrase, Islamo-fascism, but I think they're afraid not enough people understood it, even though it had the sort of heavyweight phrase, or the heavyweight syllables of fascism in it. But now they're talking about the enemy being radical Islam, and the cartoon dispute, of course, gives them things to point to and say, aha, there are examples of radical Islam. There's some suggesting that it's working. For example, the poll numbers suggest that more and more Americans think that Iran really is a serious problem, since they find politicians of the right and left in America, as we say, sort of laughingly running the gamut from A to B, right and left in America saying, oh, we can't possibly have mad mullahs in Iran with nuclear weapons. I'm quoting Barack Obama there, and his friend John Cain, too, and, of course, Mrs. Clinton and the administration. That sort of unanimity works. Americans are telling pollsters now, oh yes, Iran is a serious problem. We can't allow those mad mullahs to have nuclear weapons. And you wouldn't think this was possible, Paul. I mean, it's such a reprise of the run-up to the war in Iraq. But it seems to be working.
It hasn't,
at least the pollsters seem to think so.
It isn't just starting with this particular crop. I mean, this goes This goes back to the demonization of Mossadegh, who we overthrew so many years ago. He was actually a liberal Democrat, and the upshot of putting the Shah in was that, you know, a coalition of everybody in opposition got in power, and the U.S. actually helped the mullahs rise over the socialists.
Quite
another
right.
case where the left opposition gets marginalized because the U.S. prefers to have a fanatic a religious group in power than having some perhaps sober-eyed leftists who actually, you know, want to do something for their own population.
The problem is that the overthrow of the elected government in Iran by the CIA, Kermit Roosevelt, as a matter of fact, was more than 50 years ago. And it's only people like you and me, Paul, who remember it and talk about it.
Well, and the Iranians.
And it's not in America. And the fact that it's not being talked about in America, and that the situation, I mean, even the history of sort of Jimmy Carter and the Shah, you know, is forgotten, just as Jimmy Carter is, although he tried to remind people who he was, I guess, at the Coretta Scott King funeral. In any case, Americans are buying this sort of propaganda, and that's scary, because on that basis, the administration, as you say, if they get their backs really to the wall, are capable of terrible adventures here in order to try to garner support, and this sort of attitude amongst Americans is a basis for that.
I wanted to tie up a loose end because I mentioned Ali Abu Nima cited a Guardian article about this business about the caricature of Christ not being published. I haven't actually still found that. Someone did email me in response to my query that the Der Spiegel has something. And if you Google Comic Kampf, Kampf meaning struggle, mm-hmm. my struggle was Hitler's book, no relations, just the word,
right.
K-A-M-P-F,
right.
Comic Kampf. You've emailed that. When I did Google search, I got the article first, top of the page. So you can read why the Jilens Postens, why we shouldn't believe this is some big exercise in free speech, because they didn't want to extend it to.
Well, it may be an exercise in free speech, but
only an exercise, not sincere, because as he said.
Sincerity.
We think these cartoons would cause an outrage. That's why we won't use them. That's mm-hmm. what he said about some drawings.
Right.
He didn't say it about another.
So I mean the hypocrisy of the editor or the editorial board of that paper may be clear, but I mean the issue is, it seems to me, not in any interesting way a free speech issue. I mean I don't think too many people in Europe or America are saying this sort of drawing should be prohibited by law or struck out by a censor. At the same time, they're recognizing that they are just as inflammatory as the editor described the other cartoons in question as being. So, yeah, I mean, it's not a free speech issue, I think.
Since the DI published five of them, maybe we should write the DI and ask them to publish the cartoons of Christ that weren't that the Jylands Post didn't.
Well, actually, there's a more recent example. Wasn't there a great flap at the Daily Illini a year or so ago over a cartoon on the cartoon page that made some ironic references to Jewish bankers with big noses or something like that, and there was great viewing with alarm.
Well, there was a cartoon also that showed kids, Palestinian kids, becoming bombers.
Okay, but my point is that the Daily Illini was pilloried by the administration at the university and others outside, predictably the News Gazette and other organizations that normally do that sort of things for daring to print this one cartoon. Now they, on the basis of free speech, they are printing the Muslim ones. That's fine, but I would expect the same people to condemn these new cartoons as condemned the cartoon a year ago. I haven't heard that happening.
What about free speech at funerals? I guess the taste is invoked there.
Former President Bush doesn't like that very much, apparently. He says they're being mean to his son, yes. I mean, once again, the ironies. We hear nothing from former President Bush until this thing, and the complaint is that Joseph Lowery and former President Clinton were taking political...
Carter.
But it was Carter who were taking political shots at George W. Bush, according to his father. Now, that's quite amazing, Paul. I mean, it's... the notion that the condemnation of the war policy and of the spying and so forth should be considered political shots in the first place, and secondly, the remarkable degree of outrage shown by conservative pundits that people should dare to mention such a thing at such a sacred occasion as a funeral. None of this rings true.
Yeah,
exactly.
And eavesdropped on, and that's all that...
That's right.
Carter, commented on the Katrina response, too,
yep.
and the implicit racism involved there. And we have another chapter in that saga ongoing, too, with a testimony by some Army folks at the Senate hearings, and then
yes.
Brownie's back. He's attacking his bosses.
Exactly. Yeah, he's not. He's playing for the other side now.
I don't know whether Bush was on the phone or not. He didn't. He never spoke up, so I never knew whether he was there or not. No, I'm making that up. That's not what he said. He said he was there so much that I didn't actually pay attention to whether Bush was on the conference call or not, which is really bogus. But then, you know. Some things are sacred, and that includes Bush's vacations, apparently. So.
But the ineptitude of this administration in so many ways, from screwing up the occupation of Iraq, which should have been a cakewalk, to the horrors surrounding the hurricanes.
Do you believe it should have been a cakewalk?
I don't
take that seriously at all.
Oh yeah.
No, I.
Oh
I,
come on! I mean, look. The U.S. has had more trouble occupying Iraq than the Germans had occupying France. I mean, it should have. The country was prostrate. It had no military to speak of, and we bought off what military was left. The U.S. should have been able to walk in there and establish a sort of control, in a short amount of time.
I think maybe they did believe
in
that.
In fact, it was what they did. They did it so brutally and so arrogantly that they produced a reaction, a serious reaction, against them by the Iraqi people. And the numbers that we have now, numbers we've had consistently all along, overwhelming numbers of Iraqis want the Americans out, and large numbers say, and indeed, it's perfectly reasonable to attack them until they go. I mean, this is quite astonishing, Paul.
I don't share that. I think there's no way to subtly and artfully occupy a country. If we'd have been the way to
didn't the Germans do it in 1940?
Toppled Saddam Hussein. would have been to do it and then leave, but that wasn't really the motivation.
Exactly.
The motivation was to have the lingering and the permanent bases, et cetera, it seems to
of
me.
Of course it was.
Because we're right there looking over the Saudi oil.
That's right.
And as you pointed out, this area of Iran where the oil production
exactly.
is right next on the border, too. So, you know.
And although all American politicians, one time or another, pays lip service to the notion that, well, the U.S. is not going to be there forever, we don't want to build permanent bases there. In fact, the U.S. is building permanent bases there, and it does indeed intend to be there forever in the sense that the control of the oil resources of Iraq shall be in our hands one way or another, regardless. Yeah. That
well,
is a non-negotiable for any American government.
They're talking about the long haul and the long war. And,
yeah, exactly.
They try to intimate that, you know, we're going to do some reductions as the other forces stand up, et cetera, et cetera. But that's just, to my mind, that'll just play until the election cycle is passed in a year or so, and then we'll be back to the long war again.
Exactly, and you know that they have, that's right. I mean, I agree with you. There may be actual drawdown of troops in Iraq between now and November, so the administration can say, yes, see, we are moving in the right direction. But there is no intention to leave. They're not going to leave, and, that'll be true of the next administration, that if it happens to be Democratic.
Let's see.
One comment I liked in connection with your remark about what people remember about the relationship between the U.S. and Iran and the shocking difference between what Iranians remember and what Americans remember. Gore Vidal has been bobbing around on Democracy Now! And other places recently and using his favorite phrase, or one of his favorite phrases, the United States of Amnesia, to talk about the way in which people in this country do not know the recent history and the continuity of policy that recent history demonstrates on the part of the American government. And it's worthwhile. It's a worthwhile point to make, I think. The only problem I have with it is that Vidal implies, without saying, or one can infer from what he says, perhaps, that this amnesia on the part of the American populace is simply a matter of fecklessness and lack of application on the part of Americans to pay attention to their history and so forth. Maybe an element of that there. But much more important is the manufacture of consent, to borrow another phrase, the construction of the political mind of Americans that this administration is involved in for in the narrow sense in terms of its own particular propaganda, but also, that activity is part of the larger sense in which American political parties, all the allowable ones, are engaged in this process all the time. Chomsky, in whose honor, as I say, this program is named, used this term, the manufacture of consent, to talk about the ongoing process whereby the United States of Amnesia is created. And we have to pay attention to that. That remains every bit important, perhaps more so now than it was when it was described by Chomsky and Herman a while ago.
Well, I go back and forth about incompetence and, you know, from Cheney's point of view, you know, if we tough it out and if they can sell this stuff and sell the amnesia that it'll take to manufacture it in the near term, things aren't going that bad for Halliburton. They're racking up the money.
Yeah, exactly. Good point.
So you know,
oil companies doing nicely. Thank
yes,
you.
Yes, yeah, indeed, right. Extremely nicely. But on the other hand, there's a lot of flax and incompetence and crony hangers-on, and we've had the experience of Brownie with his inflated resume. Well, there's another guy who's just quit named George Deutsch. 24-year-old guy was the guy that was in charge of boulderizing the reports from the government about global warming. He was attacked directly, I guess, by a guy from NASA, who also works with NOAA, says that they're all being told, you know. So this guy had to quit. I don't know how he inflated his resume. I guess he claimed a degree didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
But, and we have, on that issue, 86 evangelicals came up this week to back a major initiative to fight global warming.
I think that's so important. Yeah, that was because
it's not this James Watt. The world, you know, we're gonna it's all gonna be over right. Armageddon soon enough. So why do we have to worry about being stewards of the Earth? Well, there's a strong countervailing impulse.
Well, I think that's right.
It is a good thing.
Yeah, I agree with you. That is important, and it shows that the sort of the notion that the Bush administration has a politics which is firmly based in an unalterable religio-political view on the part of some Americans, particularly those associated with the evangelical tradition in American Christianity, that's not quite true. That's a good deal more flexible than it is. The numbers who have been turning against the administration, as the polls have shown recently, included a lot of these people as well. And that's worthwhile. It may even be a hope. Hopeful sign. On the other hand, there are many sort of non-hopeful signs. The one that I found most shocking this week was the force feeding of Guantanamo detainees and the breaking of the hunger strike in Guantanamo. The way that's been managed, both in terms of the brutality of the actual action and the coverage, the management of the news of it. I mean, that. Look, when the IRA strikers, hunger strikers in Britain, fasted to death 30 years ago, this was a major issue in Thatcher's Britain. The Thatcher's government was not able to cover this over in the way that the Bush government has been able to do it here. And that certainly seems to me to be a case of amnesia that we should really be worried about.
Some of the coverage was amazing. It was sort of like applauding how they decided, well, we'll just use bigger tubes to shove down their nose, and they'll find it so offensive they'll start eating, so torturous, and it's explicit use of torture to break their wills.
That's right.
It's astonishing that it's reported so.
And this happens in the same week where we get actually some numbers about the people in Guantanamo, including that a substantial number of them. Remember, Bush and Rumsfeld were going around saying these are all the most dangerous people around, the worst of the worst, who were captured on the battlefield, and they have to be kept there because they're so incredibly dangerous. Substantial numbers of these folks were never involved in any hostile activities at all. Now this comes clear from the little court surveillance that we're getting of the prisoners in Guantanamo. Well, I mean, the outrage should be much higher, Paul, and that's something once again that the administration has been able to manage, unfortunately.
There is a reservoir of outrage, material from bushcommission.org, material from the informal hearings by Conyers about the NSA stuff. That's all up.
That's
Pacifica
very important.
Has the latter, and bushcommission.org has a lot of material from the Second Riverside Church gathering on International Commission on Crimes. So you can find out about it if you want to, but bread and circuses like the Olympics, apparently.
Yeah.
Which was a bit of fun last night, I have to admit.
And you enjoy that, huh?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, I was flipping back and forth.
Spending your time on sporting events, are you, Paul?
No, I just was watching the opening
ceremonies. Oh, the opening ceremonies, which I hear were a little strange.
They did a Ferrari doing donuts. That was the most amazing part. I think...
You mentioned the Conyers thing. 22 representatives, 22 members of the House of Representatives, have now signed on to Conyers' impeachment resolution.
Huh.
This is important.
Ron Paul from Texas.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I actually haven't seen the list. I just saw the number. And but still, you know, that's quite remarkable. More power to him. I did see, talking about people from the House. You did see Charlie Rangel's comment this week. You know that?
No,
I didn't. Oh yeah, he was after the, I think it was after the King funeral, but John Rangel, a black representative from New York, said that, after all, we have to thank Bush, George W. Bush, for the things that he's actually done. For example, says Rangel, he has destroyed forever the myth of white supremacy. That's not bad for Black History Month or whatever. But there's... I started with the CIA today. The CIA is very much on my mind. Did you see that Italy is planning to try those CIA agents who snatched the guy in absentia? Exactly.
I didn't know that.
Because they have the names of 24 CIA agents. And it seems to be a wonderful, I mean, it's a... Inspector Clouseau operation, apparently, because they spent, you know, immense amount of money living in the best hotels and not covering themselves at all. They were so arrogant, the CIA guys, about what they did. The the details of the actual operation are wonderfully embarrassing in spite of everything else. And in the midst of a president, in the midst of an election in Italy, an election where the Berlusconi is in some trouble, and you'd think he'd like to keep a lid on this, he's not going to be able to, or maybe the reason is that he's in such trouble that he can't keep a lid on it. And so, you know, we may hear from this Italian court something more about CIA operations. We have a guy in foreign affairs who ran the intelligence for the Middle East from 2000 to 2005, now writing an article saying that the CIA, that the administration cherry-picked the intelligence that they wanted in order to make their case for the war. Well, we all know that.
Paul Postal guy, but it's coming
Pilar,
out.
Yeah, Paul, yeah, Pilar. Yeah. But the point is that this is now being, exactly, it's coming out in foreign, an article in foreign affairs, it's being said by the CIA members themselves. This is the crumbling of the Bush administration facade. It seems to me to be going on.
CIA was involved in the extraordinary rendition on the streets of Milan. If you want to read some more about that and some actions in this country about that, StopTortureNow.org has an interesting story of some actions in North Carolina where Kathy Kelly even was involved in protesting a company whose airplanes are used in delivering people to torture on the U.S. behalf.
You've been listening to News from Neptune. Carl Estrick and Paul Muth talking about the news of the week and its coverage by the media. Inshallah, we'll be back next week.